I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration is making a final diplomatic push for stability in the Middle East. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
In Israel, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan was trying to cinch a ceasefire deal with Hamas and pushed back on the idea Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu wants to hold off until Donald Trump takes office.
I got the sense today from the Prime Minister he's ready to do a deal.
Sullivan's not punting either.
I wouldn't be here today if I thought this thing was just waiting till after January 20th.
Saying conditions are ripe for a deal given rapid-fire changes in the region. Meantime, in Jordan.
We're back in the region at a time of both real promise, but also peril for Syria and for its neighbors.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken was focused on a peaceful transition of power in Damascus. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Anger in the Syrian capital is palpable as families search for loved ones who are now missing or have died in their fallen government's brutal prison system. At a rally in Damascus, VOA's Heather Murdoch reports that crowds are calling for the execution of ousted President Bashar al-Assad.
Everyone you speak to here says they lost someone to the brutal prison system that collapsed with the regime. At the notorious Saydnaya prison, families search for clues that may help them find their missing loved ones. Many believe there are missing prisoners who are still alive in long-hidden secret facilities. People tell us that their relatives were arrested for unknown reasons, or for saying something negative about the government, or even for living in an area populated by activists or rebels. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Damascus.
This is VOA News. Doctors for Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva said he had a second surgery on Thursday following the 79-year-old's emergency operation earlier this week to relieve bleeding in his skull. Reuters correspondent Angela Johnston reports.
Doctors said the second procedure was successful and that the leftist leader might be able to start working again next week. Doctors operated on Lula for about 2 hours on Tuesday to drain bleeding between his brain and meningeal membrane. They said it was linked to a fall at his home in late October. The second procedure on Thursday was described as preventative to minimize the risk of future bleeding. Lula's condition has raised doubts about the president's intention to run for re-election in 2020.
Reuters correspondent Angela Johnston. A new watchdog report released on Thursday found the FBI had intelligence missteps before the January 6th U.S. Capitol riot. AP correspondent Haya Panjwani reports.
The report says the FBI should have done more to collect intelligence before the Capitol riot, even though the Bureau did prepare for the possibility of violence on January 6, 2021. It also says no undercover FBI employees were present that day, and none of the Bureau's informants were cleared to participate. The report from the Justice Department Inspector General's office knocks down a fringe conspiracy theory by some Republicans in Congress that the FBI played a role in instigating the events of January 6th. Haya Panjwani, Washington.
The suspect charged with murdering an American healthcare CEO has seen online support since his arrest, with donations for his legal defense, messages backing him, and some even celebrating the crime. Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen reports.
Street art in Seattle depicts Mario Brothers video game character Luigi and a crossed-out United Healthcare logo referencing Luigi Mangione. Mangione has been charged with murder in a brazen shooting outside a Manhattan hotel before an industry conference, setting off a five-day manhunt for the masked assailant. Other images in Seattle show sick children featuring the words deny, defend, and depose, which were reportedly written on the ammunition used in the shooting. The crime has led to an outpouring of anger from Americans struggling to receive and pay for medical care. Mangione suffered from chronic back pain that impacted his daily life, according to friends and social media posts, though it is unclear whether his personal health played a role in the shooting.
Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bossy in Washington. Today is Friday, December 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Enraged Syrians call for execution of ousted President Bashar al-Assad.
Rage in Damascus is deep and widespread at this funeral for a prominent victim of prison torture. People call for the execution of President Bashar al-Assad.
Biden aides in the Middle East push for peace in Syria and Gaza. The deputy leader of Tanzania's main opposition Chadema party announces his campaign for the party's leadership. Malawi president appeals for international food aid.
If you are out there standing with Malawians and giving them the help they need during this crisis, I can assure you that Malawians are honest and fair-minded people who will remember those who are bringing them food in this season of drought and hunger.
And South Sudan instructs the 8 counties in eastern Equatorial State to collect taxes to pay civil servants' salaries across the state. The stories for Samson O'Malley's Post are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Anger permeates the Syrian capital as families search for loved ones who are missing or have died in their fallen government's brutal prison system. At a rally in Damascus, viewers Heather Murdoch reports that outraged crowds are calling for the execution of ousted President Bashar al-Assad.
Rage in Damascus is deep and widespread. At this funeral for a prominent victim of prison torture, people call for the execution of President Bashar al-Assad, less than a week after he fled the country. Everyone you speak to here says they lost someone to the brutal prison system that collapsed with the regime. We found this woman weeping on the sidewalk.
My God, where is my son? I want to see him, hold him, and smell him. I don't know where he is. They took him from me. I hope God takes them.
The young man being buried, Mazen Alhameda, died in prison after speaking publicly about being tortured. At this hospital, families are searching for the bodies of people they believe to have died recently. Pictures of the bodies hang on the walls outside. Many, we are told, have wounds that appear to be from torture. Inside the hospital, dozens of bodies await identification. But most families who have come here don't find their relatives. This is Majda Abu Al-Omani, a mother of 2 missing young men.
My sons were arrested in 2014. They gave us death certificates, but we didn't know what happened to them. The scene in here is indescribable. It makes your hair gray.
At the notorious Sednaya prison, other families search for clues that may help them find their missing loved ones. Many believe there are missing prisoners who are still alive in long-hidden secret facilities. At the prison, Khamis El-Ibrahim is searching for his brother.
There are living souls under this ground, not just 1 or 2. It's been 4 or 5 days we've been here at Sednaya, and so far, nothing.
People tell us that their relatives were arrested for unknown reasons, or for saying something negative about the government, or even for living in an area populated by activists or rebels. Since we have been here, many people have come up to us to express their anger and their sadness, with one man saying, "People all over the world have known about this for decades, and why are we just coming to film now?" Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Damascus.
Top aides to U.S. President Joe Biden are in the Middle East this week to push for a ceasefire in Gaza and to deal with the fallout in Syria following the ouster of President Bashar al-Assad. The visits come amid military operations from neighboring countries, including U.S. allies, Israel, and Turkey. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wadekuswara has this report.
Celebrations in Latakia, the heartland of ousted Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's minority Alawite community, as neighboring countries make their moves. Israeli troops advance deeper into the UN-patrolled buffer zone, separating the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights and Syrian territory, following hundreds of Israeli airstrikes across Syria. In Israel Thursday, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan met with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Sullivan defended the U.S. allies' actions.
What Israel saw was an immediate threat. The collapse of a structure that had been in place for a long time and the potential for that vacuum to be filled by a direct proximate threat right across. So it moved in to fill that threat. That from the United States' perspective, is logical and consistent with Israel's right to self-defense.
The United Nations said Israel's actions violates the country's 1974 disengagement agreement with Syria, signed after the 1973 Mideast War. United Nations Special Rapporteur Ben Saul.
There is absolutely no basis under international law to preventively or preemptively disarm a country you don't like.
Meanwhile, Syrian Kurds near the northern border with Turkey have been displaced amid clashes between U.S.-backed Kurdish forces and Ankara-backed Syrian rebels. The U.S. brokered a ceasefire deal between the groups Wednesday. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was in Jordan Thursday before heading to Ankara. He said Turkey faces a real threat from Kurdish separatists.
At the same time, again, we want to avoid sparking any kinds of additional conflicts inside of Syria at a time when we want to see this transition to an interim government and to a better way forward for Syria. And part of that also has to be ensuring that ISIS doesn't rear its ugly head again.
Blinken and Sullivan are also making a last-ditch diplomatic push to achieve a deal to end fighting between Israel and Hamas in Gaza that would also free hostages held by the U.S.-designated terror group. The U.S. believes Hamas is holding 3 living American hostages and the bodies of 4 others. Patsy Udahuswara, VOA News, Washington.
Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera has renewed his appeal for international assistance to address severe food shortages affecting more than one quarter of the country's population of 20 million. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi is currently facing one of its worst food shortage situations in decades, with about 5.7 million people affected, according to a recent Malawi Vulnerability Assessment Committee report. This is about a quarter of the country's population of about 20 million people. In rural areas, some villages were reported to be surviving on wild plants like buffalo beans. In a televised address to the nation Wednesday evening, Chakwera discussed the ongoing issue.
We are not out of the woods yet. This is why I continue to lobby for international support to address the humanitarian crisis we are facing.
In March of this year, the president appealed for $200 million in food aid for millions of citizens facing starvation due to a drought linked to El Nino weather condition. In his renewed appeal on Wednesday, Chakwera acknowledged the donations that Malawi has so far received from various development partners through the UN World Food Program.
From the governments of Sweden and Netherlands, the WFP received a donation of $11.8 million, and I say thank you. From the government of the United States, the WFP received a donation of $7 million. And I say thank you. From the government of the United, thank you. The WFP received a donation of $3.8 million. And I say thank you.
Chakwera said additional food aid is urgently needed to save lives.
If you are out there standing with Malawians and giving them the help they need during this crisis, I can assure you that Malawians are honest and fair-minded people who will remember those who are bringing them food in this season of drought and hunger, and who know how to distinguish them from those who brought them nothing.
Kairi Scott is the head of partnerships and communications for the UN's World Food Program in Malawi. She told VOA that the UN's food agency still needs more assistance.
At the moment, we've got funding until the end of the year, but the food gap lasts until March 2025. And so we are working really hard to make sure that we can close that gap and make sure that no one gets left behind.
In the meantime, Malawi's Department of Disaster Management Affairs, the World Food Program, and several local humanitarian organizations are distributing assistance to communities facing food shortages. Lamit Masina, VOA News, Blantyre.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Friday, December 13. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We'll be right back. The deputy chairman of Tanzania's main opposition Chadema party, Tundu Lissu, has announced his bid to run for the party's leadership. The current leader, Prima Umboy, has held the position since 2003. Lissu says he wants to enact changes in the way that the party deals with the Tanzanian government and within the party's ranks. Lissu says under his leadership, Chadema will demand constitutional and electoral reforms. Tanzania holds presidential elections in 2025. Lissu tells me that Chadema should not participate in elections unless significant changes are made in the country's electoral system. He says the party's slogan will be no reform, no elections.
Today, I formally announced my bid for the party leadership.
What happens to the current leader?
Well, he's been around 20 years, and it is high time we made the necessary change in order to move the party forward.
So what is your plan in case you become the new chairman? How do you move the party forward?
Well, where we are currently, we are in a political deadlock. The reforms that we had negotiated with President Samia Suluhu Hassan for nearly 2 years have stalled. And the way out of this impasse is for new leadership to come and show, you know, take the party in a different direction altogether. If dialogue has not worked, what do we have in the alternative? It is mass mobilization. It is, you know, to lead the party towards rousing the nation, bringing together various social groups, political parties, social organizations, bring them together in order to organize mass democratic action to force reforms.
So can we say that there is a disagreement between you and the chairman in terms of how to move the party forward?
You are right on the money. I think we have very fundamental disagreement on which way the party should go.
There have been too many developments involving the party and the government. Some of your members have been kidnapped, but we did not see a lot of action from your party.
That is precisely the point. The point is the party seems paralyzed because the current chairman does not seem to want to take Samia Suluhu Hassan on. He doesn't want to burn his bridges with the Samia regime. Our party leaders and activists have been murdered in the most horrible way. Our cadres, our district leaders have been abducted and disappeared. For all intents and purposes, we are back to where we were during the dark days of the Magufuli regime. And the party leadership doesn't seem to know how to get out of this rut. So I'm challenging for the party leadership precisely because we need to get out of this situation.
You have been quoted as saying that the new slogan for Chadema should be no reforms, no election. Can you explain this?
We had local elections like 2-3 weeks ago, and they were a total disaster. They were worse than the 2020 general elections in terms of manipulation of the elections on a national scale. So if this is going to be the norm in our elections, it has become clear to us that they are not prepared to have electoral competition in the country. Now, if they are not prepared to allow electoral competition, then why should we participate in future elections? What for? So we have decided the only way to get us back into elections is to carry out thoroughgoing reforms of the electoral system. And therefore, our position is we fight for reform. And once we have reforms, we'll be happy to participate in future elections. But as things stand, no reform, no elections.
You are also calling for reforms within Chadema, including term limits.
Absolutely, yes. We cannot deal with the Samia dictatorship if our own ranks are what they are currently. And therefore, we must put our house in order first. We must clean up our own act before we can successfully confront the Samia regime. If we don't, it will demoralize our people. and we will not be able to deal with the major challenges that are affecting us as far as Samia Suluhu Hassan's regime is concerned.
Mr. Lesu, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on your program.
Tundu Lissu is the deputy chair of Tanzania's main opposition Chadema party. He announced on Thursday that he's running for the chairmanship of the party, and he was speaking with us from Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. The commissioners of the eight counties in South Sudan's eastern equatorial state have been instructed to collect taxes to pay civil servant salaries across the state. Some commissioners say tax collection could hurt traders who pay multiple taxes as importers of goods from East Africa. Kaltuma Vanessa reports for VOA from Torit.
They just concluded 8th Governors Forum in Juba. The heads of the 10 states and 3 administrative areas were instructed to allocate resources within each state to facilitate the payment of civil servants' salaries. Elia John Ahaji, Minister of Information for Eastern Equatorial State, says the state government is reminding county authorities about the obligations.
We are not telling the county commissioners to go and introduce their own. Those individuals who have been starting operationalizing the harmonized tax, they will take from there. But the counties or government institutions which have not adopted that tax harmonized, it is the time they should start doing so.
David Nayelo Moore, Commissioner of Capuetan North, says tax collection will push traders to increase their prices. He also says that residents and civil servants who have not been paid for 1 year face challenges as they struggle to put food on the table for their families.
I think it will be really very hard for a county like Capuetan North and others may not be able to make it so fast because, when you look at the structure or the type of the market, it is a mini market, a very small one. If you can count, you can count shop, they will not reach even 20, which if you send people to collect tax from there, they will not clock to 200,000 or 500,000, which is going to be really very difficult. Looking at the people and the livelihood, looking at what they are doing, they are collecting these charcoals, getting the firewood, and if you start taxing those things in a higher prices, they may end up running away. We took an example from those who are collecting vegetables. You find if they are asked to pay the £100, they are not able to pay.
A businessman who did not want to be identified for fear of government retaliation says multiple taxes on traders could increase the prices of commodities in the markets across the state.
When taxes have been added, it means also me as a businessman, I will have transferred that tax to the commodity which I sell. And in the long run, when we are operating the business, it means the final consumer is the one who lastly bear that burden. So me as a businessman, I will be affected. But the one who will carry the most burden is the final consumer.
Eastern Equatorial State Minister of Finance Peter Lokujulo Terimoi says the state government needs 635 million South Sudanese pounds for operating costs and salaries each month. For VOA News, I am Kaltuma Vanessa, reporting from Eastern Equatorial State Capital, Torit.
Niger's ruling military junta suspended the BBC for 3 months over its coverage of an extremist attack that allegedly killed dozens of Nigerian soldiers and civilians, the authorities said on Thursday. The BBC said it had no comment on the suspension. Popular BBC programs, including those in Hausa, the most spoken language in Niger, are broadcast in the Central African country through local radio partners to reach a large audience across the region. The United States on Thursday said it welcomed the accord reached by Somalia and Ethiopia to end regional tensions sparked by Addis Ababa's push for maritime access. The two countries had been at loggerheads since landlocked Ethiopia struck a deal in January with Somalia's breakaway region of Somaliland to lease a stretch of coastline for a port and a military base. But on Wednesday, regional power Turkey, which had brokered talks between Somalia and Ethiopia, announced the two sides had reached a deal that would ensure reliable, safe, and sustainable access to the sea for Ethiopia under the sovereign authority of the Federal Republic of Somalia. A new initiative is reshaping the lives of smallholder farmers and students in Malawi. The homegrown school feeding program, championed by the UN World Food Program, is bringing the gap, is bridging the gap between agriculture and public primary schools, resulting in improved nutrition for students and economic empowerment for farmers. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Pirirani Nkwate is a small-scale farmer in the Zumba district of southern Malawi. She says that about 5 years ago, she started making more money selling her crops directly to her local primary school than she did selling to middlemen.
This program has helped earn money to pay school fees for my two children. I've also bought two cows, something I never imagined before. Now I have a steady income.
Nkwate is part of the UN World Food Program's Homegrown School Feeding Program. Since its pilot effort in 2012, the program has grown to support over 800,000 students and 35,000 farmers in 11 districts across the country. Paul Tanibu is World Food Program's country director in Malawi.
It provides farmers with reliable markets for up to 200 school days annually, boosting incomes and resilience, and it promotes dietary diversity, offering school children meals with ingredients from Malawi's six food groups.
Donors supporting the initiative include Norway, the European Union, France, and Iceland. Students say the initiative is better than the previous feeding program, which had one fixed meal. Gladys Leo is a student at Nyakienda Primary School in southern Malawi's Sanje district.
In the past, we were eating porridge made from soy flour only. But now, with the coming of this homegrown initiative, we are eating porridge from maize flour, potatoes cooked with ground nut flour, rice and pumpkins, and sometimes potatoes mixed with vegetables.
The World Food Program says the initiative has helped increase daily school attendance from 77% to 92% and reduce health-related absenteeism by 11%. However, some schools like Nyachenda Primary School in Nsanje District, the challenge is delays in supplies. Daniel Yohane is a deputy head teacher at Nyachenda Primary School.
We use the smallholder farmers that lack a lot of resources, and because of that, the food comes to our school maybe with 2 or 3 days late.
World Food Program says it is addressing the challenge, sourcing food from farmers in cooperatives around the schools. The farmers say the initiative has helped them earn enough money to construct houses, while for students, it promises a healthier and a brighter future. Lamek Masina, VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
And that's it for this Friday, December 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV show, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Butter in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week. And we'll see you again on Monday morning.
Gender-based violence is redundant to some, but it is one that cannot be ignored. The World Health Organization maintains that globally, 1 in 3 women, around 736 million, are subjected to physical or sexual violence. On the next episode of Our Voices, we join the world in the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. Join the conversation on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on the Voice of America.